I'm Steve Snyder. I'm president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association and the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. I'm here at the Belgium Heritage Center to make a presentation about my book, Shot Down, a True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Moore. They were shot down and were occupied Belgium on February 8th, 1944. And the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help. My dad was missing in action for 7 months. He evaded capture with the help of Belgian people and got back to England. So after the presentation, I'm going to be signing my book, special today. It's usually $27.95, but I'm selling it for 10% off, $25 tonight. It's available really where any books are sold. Most people buy it on Amazon. It's available in many aviation museums. In fact, the EAA Aviation Museum in Oshawa.
I'm Roy Alexander with the Belgium Heritage Center, the president of the Heritage Center. Just a couple things here. If you haven't known where the restroom is, to your right, down the hallway there, we have a restroom. I'd like to thank Gary Schubwehr and Bill Schubwehr and Gary Vandenhoeven, who kind of put this presentation together. So thank you guys for doing that. We have a part of the Peninsula Belgian American Club. We're celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. We've got a little display here, so if you get a chance out of there. Also, after the program, we'll be here, so you're more than welcome to stick around and look around if you haven't had a chance to see anything. You'll see people walking around with the Heritage Center shirts. Just if you've got any questions about the Peninsula Belgian American Club or the Heritage Center, feel free to ask. We have a donation box in the back. We always appreciate donations. If you enjoy the activities here, we really appreciate the donations. So what I'd like to do is thank Tom here very much. Steve. Very much for coming to the question.
Tom Snyder was a newscaster.
That's what it was. So I'd like to introduce Steve. Thank you very much for coming out here and taking the time and from a distance to give the presentation. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. Well, I'm just delighted to be here. Wait till I tell all my friends in Belgium about this. They're gonna get a kick out of it. And what a great crowd. Thanks for coming out. I greatly appreciate it. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. He was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over Europe. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years. And I just wanted to go through that and organize it and maybe learn some more details. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. It's absolutely riveting, so much so that it was included in two books that were written. On your left was The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor. It was about the 8th Air Force who flew its first mission on August 17th of 1942. And the goal was to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The 8th Air Force got the moniker, the Mighty Eighth, from noted historian Roger Freeman because of the number of planes they could put up on missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin. It's hard to imagine that many bombers being up in the sky at the same time. The other book was First Over Germany. It was about the 306 Bomb Group and the 8th Air Force that my dad was in. It was written by Russell Strong, who was a navigator in the 306 Bomb Group and became the group's historian after the war. The 306 got its motto, First Over Germany, because they were the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And he was really candid in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like in the air base, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And reading those letters was just fascinating, and I became fascinated with the story, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I found relatives of all my dad's crew members and asked them for any information they could give to me. Started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my search, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling, it needed to be told, so I wrote a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years, and I actually formed my own publishing company called Seabreeze Publishing, which is the name of the street that I live on in Seal Beach, California. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards in Belgium. And it's just not about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. But I couldn't have written it if it wasn't for a couple Belgium gentlemen. On the left, my dad has his bomber jacket on with Dr. Paul Delahaye. That picture was taken in 1994 at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and of my dad's plane being shot down. And then the picture on the right is me and Jacques Lalot. That was taken 20 years later at the 70th anniversary. These two men were young boys during the Nazi occupation, and they were greatly affected by it because they saw firsthand atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a huge debt. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft implemented in the fall of 1940 by President Roosevelt. My dad went into the Army in April of 1942. And at the time, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in military strength in the world behind Romania. And you can tell by the World War I vintage uniform he has on here that they were very ill-equipped as well. He was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, Washington State. 3 months later, he married Ruth Hempel at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena, California. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena, as was I. It was right after she graduated from UCLA, where she was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. I also graduated from the UCLA, and my classmate was Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and he moved to California when he was 13 with his family right before he started high school. A few months later, on December 7th, a date which will live in infamy, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was very afraid at that time. The future was very uncertain. So she decided to go up to Washington over Christmas and visit my dad. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, my dad was concerned how he was going to support his family as a new bride, a baby on the way, and he didn't think he could do that very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he volunteered for the Air Force so he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 1942, he went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana Army Air Base in California, which is only about 20 minutes from where I live. And then he went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's pretty busy, but starting on the left, you see the three main stages of pilot training. First was primary training, then if you made it through primary, you went into basic. And pilot training was very tough. 40% of the cadets that started washed out, and they became either bombardiers, navigators, or maybe gunners. And then after basic, they went into advanced pilot training, and that's when they separated the pilots out. They either went into fighters, single-engine planes, or bombers, or twin-engine planes, which resulted into bombers. Typically, the smaller pilots went into the fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit My dad was 6'3", so he went into bombers. But personally, I think it was also based on personality. To me, you know, all the fighter pilots I've ever met have been pretty cocky, have these big egos, be risk takers, and be pretty individualistic, as opposed to the bomber pilots that tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad in primary training at Santa Maria, California. This was a big day for him. It was the first time he soloed. And back then, you couldn't wear your goggles on your helmet unless you had soloed. You see him smoking a cigarette there. I think everyone back then smoked. Here you see the three planes that my dad flew in pilot training. In primary, flew a old Biman biplane. And then in basic pilot training, he flew a Vultee Valiant single-wing plane. And then in advanced training, he flew a twin-engine Curtiss-Wright 18-9. My dad graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943, where he earned his commission as a second lieutenant in his pilot's wings. And from there, he went to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. And then from there, he went on to operational crew training, where the various members of the team or the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. On October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 bomb group at Thurlow, England. It was located about 60 miles north of London, and this is what the base looked like back then. It's no longer there, but the surrounding countryside looks just the same. It's all rural farmland. There is a nice little museum there, though, that I visited several times. It contains lots of different artifacts, memorabilia, history, and stories. Here you see the insignia of the 306 bomb group. There were three air divisions in the 8th Air Force. The 306 was in the 1st Air Division, which was signified by a triangle. And then every bomb group had a letter designation. And for the 306, there was an H. So triangle H was their call sign. In addition to being the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, the 306 was also the longest serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force. They arrived in England in September of 1942. It didn't go back home until December of 1946. They stayed on after the war, involved in the Casey Jones Project, which was the aerial photo mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa. Probably many of you have seen the 1949 movie, 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by 3. Another distinction of the 306 is that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Bomber Command General Ira Aker to implement a mission limit in April of 1943. Up until that point, there was no mission limits, and the morale of these combat crews was going into the tank because they realized they would never, ever make it home. They'd either be killed or shot down and become a prisoner of war. Dr. Schuller suggested a mission limit of 20. Aker set it at 25. But at least these combat crews had a light at the end of the tunnel and some hope of making it back to their families. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons. These were the squadrons that the 306. Up in the upper left, I'll point out, their nickname was the Clay Pigeons because they took more losses than any other bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force. My dad's squadron was in the lower right, the 69th Fighting Biden, and they had one of the least losses of any bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force. I always like to point out the ground crews. The combat crews got all the recognition and all the glory, but these ground crews are the ones that kept these planes in the air. After a mission, these bombers would come back all beat up, and these ground crews would stay up all through the night, usually in very inclement weather, sleet, snow, mud, ice, rain. And they would repair battle damage, do maintenance on the plane, replace engines, replace tires. And they took great pride in these planes. They really considered these bombers their plane. They just loaned out to the combat crews occasionally to fly missions. So they were really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew. B-17 had a 10-man crew. They had four officers who were kneeling in front. My dad's on the lower left. He was the first pilot and as such the commander of the plane and the crew. And then going across, you have the co-pilot, the navigator, and the bombardier. And then standing behind them, you have six enlisted men who were mainly gunners. Five of these men came home, but five of them did not. That's not the Susan Ruth that they took their picture in front of. It was just another B-17 that was handy. I always like to point out the Nozard in the upper left. I love the Nozard. It's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines didn't, the Navy didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it could help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes and what they named and painted on them. And they were very creative in what they painted on their planes. Many times with a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a scantily clad or nude woman. After all, these two guys were in their late teens and early 20s and virile young men. The 306 flew B-17s. The 1st and 3rd Air Divisions flew B-17s, and the 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. The B-17 was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament that they had on the plane. They had 13 50 caliber machine guns, so they could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. And also they could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep fighting, keep flying. Every plane had tail markings to identify them, and as you can see here, you see the triangle H again of the 306 bomb group. Then every plane had a designated tail number, which was assigned by the manufacturer. The Boeing company designed the B-17, and they produced 60%, but Lockheed, Vega, and Douglas Aircraft each built 20% as well. Here you see the crew positions on a B-17. And the nose, you have the bombardier, behind him the navigator, the two pilots, and above them the flight engineer, the bomb bay, the radio operator, ball turret gunner down below, two waist gunners, and a tail gunner. And the bombs hung in racks in the bomb bay, and it was really cramped in there. It was more crowded in a B-17 than a submarine. That catwalk's 8 inches wide, and that boy's only 8 years old, so you can see how tight it was. And on their bomb runs, it wasn't uncommon for bombs to get hung up on these racks, which require one of the crewmen to either kick it loose with his foot or take a wrench and knock it loose. And when those bomb bay doors are open, they're looking 5 miles straight down to the ground, so that took a little courage. Here you see the crew positions a little more clearly. In the nose, you have the bombardier. His main job is to drop the bombs accurately. But in the G model that had the chin turret, when they were under attack by enemy fighters, he manned the chin turret. And the navigator needed to know where they were and where they were going. And when they were under attack by enemy fighters, he manned the cheek guns that were on each side of the nose. And above them was the two pilots. You have the first pilot in the left seat, the co-pilot in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes. These missions lasted 6 to 10 hours in length. So it was very tiring, both mentally and physically. They flew in tight formations, so they had to stay alert at all times. They could clip a wing on a bomber next to them or run into the plane in front of them and go down. And they continually had to fight the turbulence. They had the normal weather turbulence that all of us have experienced in commercial flight. But they also had the turbulence of all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. So the wake turbulence and the prop wash would just churn the air. It'd be like flying in a washing machine. Then above the pilot, you had the flight engineer. He manned the top turret when they were under attack. He was also called the crew chief. He was kind of the onboard mechanic and knew how everything worked. And he would help monitor all the instruments that were in the cockpit. There were over 150 different gauges, dials, toggles, and switches. And he would peer over the pilot's shoulders to help monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. Then behind the bomb bay, you had the radio operator, had the most comfortable position on the plane. He had a relatively roomy compartment and a chair to sit at. And the most cramped position on the plane, the ball turret gunner. Again, these missions were 6 to 10 hours in length, and he's in this fetal position for hours on end, so that was pretty uncomfortable. Then above the ball, you had the two waist gunners, which was the most exposed position on the plane, and then another cramped position, the tail gunner. My dad flew his first mission on November 3rd of 1943 to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. It was the first time the 8th Air Force put up over 500 bombers on a mission. And flying combat was extremely dangerous and absolutely brutal. 26,000 men died in the 8th Air Force, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either any aircraft fire or German fighters. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. There were 40 bomb groups in an area in England called East Anglia, which was about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of admission, you had hundreds of bombers taking off all at the same time. And back then, there was no radar, there was no air traffic control. Usually the weather was socked in until they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon, and airmen lost their lives. Then they had to form up. Individual planes formed up into three-plane elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions. And all this took an hour to 2 hours before they could even begin their mission across the English Channel. Then they had to deal with the elements. These planes were pressurized, so above 10,000 feet they had to go on oxygen, or else they could pass out in a couple minutes and die. And also it was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero in those planes. So frostbite was a huge problem. And one of my dad's waist gunners was hospitalized for 2.5 months because of the seriousness of his injuries. Here you see the combat uniform that they wore. You know, look how bulky that thing is, you know, being in those tight spaces. This is actually a waist gunner. He has a steel helmet on, his tinted goggles, his oxygen mask, and then he's wearing a flak jacket. That was an apron that had metal plates in the front and the back to help protect him. And his fleece-lined jacket and pants and thermal gloves and boots. You notice the white strap around his waist. That was a parachute harness. It was so cramped in a B-17 that they didn't wear their parachutes. So if they had to bail out, they have to have their wits about them to find their parachute to begin with and then clip it on hooks on the back of the harness and then bail out. Again, you'll notice the creative nose art there. This is actually a B-24 Liberator, not a B-17. The next thing they had to deal with was enemy fighters. The Germans had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their air force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. Here you see a waist gunner firing his 50 caliber machine gun with all those spent cartridges on the floor of the plane. That was like stepping on ball bearings or marbles. The ammunition for the 50 caliber machine gun came in belts of 27 feet in length. So if a gunner fired the whole belt, they said he fired the whole 9 yards. And a lot of people think that's where that came from. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of 100 bombers at a time could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they flew in what was called a combat box formation. This is the box of a combat wing. And then within the box of the wing, you have three boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each bomb group box, you have three boxes representing bomb squadrons. So the theory was all that interlacing firepower could ward off the German fighters. But sadly, that was not the case. In the early years of the war, in 1942, 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Even though they implemented that 25 mission limit, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was only 6 in 1943. And the losses culminated in October, over a one-week period of 4 missions where they lost 148 bombers. That's almost 1,500 men, with the worst day being Black Thursday, October 14th, when they sent 291 B-17s to bomb the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt, Germany, and 60 of them. Of the 291 were shot down, 600 men. 10 of the 15 B-17s of the 306 bomb group were lost. Well, the 8th Air Force was in shock. There was absolutely no way they could sustain those losses, and they discontinued flying missions into Germany for the rest of the year. It wasn't until right at the end of 1943, the beginning of 1944, with the introduction of the P-51 Mustang, that these bomber formations finally had fighters support all the way deep into Germany to the target and back again. Here you see the combat box formation from the rear, from the top, and from the side. It's a three-dimensional formation with a lead group, a top group, and a low group. The P-51 Mustangs were extremely effective. By the time D-Day rolled around, They had just decimated the Luftwaffe, and they were just a shell of themselves, and the Allies had complete air superiority. There's a picture of a P-51 Mustang. That actually belongs to Tom Cruise, and he flew that in the movie Top Gun Maverick, if you happen to see that. That's actually housed at the Planes of Fame Air Museum in Southern California near me. The next thing they had to deal with was anti-aircraft fire. This is a flak gun. Flak was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that when they exploded, they burst out hundreds of feet, could easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of those bombers. The skin was so thin, you could just take a screwdriver and poke it right through it. From a distance, these kind of looked like innocent black puffs. But once the formation got in that killing field, those puffs got bigger, the explosions got deafening. If one exploded near the bomber, it would just violently rock the ship. If a bomber was hit directly, it would just basically disintegrate and disappear. Or if it knocked a wing off, that bomber would just plummet to the earth. My dad said that even though it was so cold at that altitude they were flying, he'd be dripping wet with sweat and his clothes would be soaked from the adrenaline running through his body. When they neared the target, they reached another predesignated point called the initial point, the IP, when they started their bomb run. And at that time, the first pilot would give control over the plane to the bombardier who would fly the bomber through the Norden bomb site, which was tied into the autopilot of the plane. It was a revolutionary device. It was an analog computer that could calculate the altitude the plane was flying, the speed of the plane, speed of the direction of the wind, speed of the wind, so they could actually drop the bombs. And it was highly secretive. The bombardiers had to take an oath for their life that they would defend this. But little did the U.S. know that the Germans had a spy, Hermann Lang, in the Norden bomb site factory and knew all about it. Here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the bomb site, and once it released the bombs, it yelled, "Bombs away!" And that would signal the first pilot to take control of the plane, make a big turn and go to another predesignated point where the bombers that made it through the formation would try to form up again and then head back to their bases in England, where once again they'd face enemy fighters. And even when they reached England, they faced a number of dangers. The weather could be socked in and they couldn't even find their bases. They could be running out of fuel. There could be dead or injured pilots on the plane. The plane might have sustained a lot of battle damage, engine out, flight controls out. So that resulted in a lot of crash landings back in England, and more airmen lost their lives. It was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1944, my dad's plane dropped their bomb successfully, but their bombardiers got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed and they fell behind the bomber formation heading back to England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. And like wolves or lions on prey, they came in for the kill in the ensuing air battle. The Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those German fighters were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he was killed. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. One day when I was doing my research, my wife says, "Well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking, oh gosh, she's so naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It'd be absolutely impossible. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do and I found Hans Berger, which was an amazing experience. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he spoke perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the mighty 8th Air Force. I mentioned that the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew. I don't have time to do that today. You'll have to buy the book to find that out. But after my dad bailed out, he came down right at the French-Belgian border, and he came down in these trees, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Devan, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. This occurred early in the afternoon. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped my dad down this tree. That's actually Henri Franken in that picture he sent these to my dad after the war. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about, many taken by Belgian people and, during the war. They told my dad it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight because there were German patrols in the area combing, looking for these guys that had bailed out. So he hunkered down and stayed hidden, and then that night they came back and got him, and they took him to the Durvan farmhouse. Those trees are in France, and that farmhouse is in Belgium, so it is right at the border. He stayed there one night only because, again, they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols still in the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilquin, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. So they headed out at night. My dad had some shrapnel wounds in one leg, so he could only pedal with his good leg. It was a pitch black, drizzly, and they came to a hill, and they couldn't pedal up anymore, so they started pushing the bike up to the hill. And they came to this little cabaret. This is what it looked like in 1994. The lights were on, the music was playing, people were laughing and dancing, and all of a sudden two German officers come walking out with two young French girls, and one of them comes up to my dad and puts his arm around him and asks him for a light for a cigarette. My dad is petrified. He can't speak German, can't speak French yet. But Paul, you know, knew what the guy wanted and lit a cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said they were too drunk, or schnockered, the way he used to put it, and too interested in these young girls that pay much attention to a couple of guys pushing a bike up a hill in the middle of the night. And after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. Here you see my dad with a few of his helpers. He had many more helpers than this. They stuck a beret on him to try to help him blend in with the locals, but as you can see, he was quite a bit taller than the local Belgian people. The Belgian people who hit my dad, or any down airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. Because if the German secret police found out, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. Here you see a couple of women who my dad stayed with for lengthy periods of time. That was Jelaine Bayou on the left. It was with her and her husband Maurice that my dad wrote his diary. And then on the right is Jeanette Gaudin. Her husband was a captain in the French army who had been captured when Germany first invaded the lowlands in 1940, and he spent the remainder of the war as a POW. In hiding all this time, it was very stressful for my dad. You know, first of all, his plane's attacked, it's on fire, he has to bail out, he comes down to a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And he's being helped by complete strangers who can't communicate with one another. My dad did have a little English-French dictionary and his escape kit that he could refer to. And any of these people might be a collaborator and turn him over to the Germans. And there are several occasions where he was almost discovered that are described in the book. On one of those occasions, it was at the Bayou home in Charleroi, actually. There was loud pounding on the door one night, and Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof, and he'd come get him when the Germans left the area. They never left the area. My dad spent the whole night up on that roof, and I've been in this building, I've been in all these buildings, and you can't see it from this angle, but there's a little tiny attic window, you know, you can barely squeeze through, and then the roof is a tile roof that's really a sharp pitch to it. And trying to get up there, I couldn't imagine myself doing that, but he spent the whole night up there. Finally, word came that Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th, and my dad decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad had that year's training in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. And he thought it was his duty to get back in the fight. Americans were fighting, Americans were dying, which was a courageous thing to do. I don't know how many people would have done that. His helpers tried to talk him out of it because if naturally in the fighting he could be killed, or if the Germans caught him, he'd be shot on the spot as a spy. The safest thing for him would have been just to stay hunkered down in hiding and then wait for the U.S. armies to come up through France to liberate the area. But he was determined to join the French resistance, so another one of his helpers, Amy Cools, escorted him across the border. They rode bicycles, and he joined a unit of the French resistance. This is not the group that he joined. It just gives you an idea of what they look like. But the French resistance were a small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. And they basically just harassed the Germans. They would sabotage railroad lines, disrupt communications, assassinate German officers, attack convoys. And they got their information from the British through coded messages over the BBC. My dad said that the information they got was amazingly accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this date at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything the Germans were up to. This was the farmhouse in Allers-en-Fagne, France, where the Mackey group stayed. It's still there today. I've climbed all through that. Here you see my dad in 1994 standing in front of it. When he was there, he stayed in the tower where you see those two windows. And on one occasion, it was early morning, he just had his skivvies on, shaving cream. He looked out the windows and the German patrol was coming up the road. So he jumped out of these green windows in the back of the farmhouse and hightailed into the woods to avoid being captured. And there's a number of encounters described in the book that the Mackey unit had with the Germans, which are pretty thrilling. Who took this picture and how it ever got back to my dad, I'll never know, but that's my dad fighting with the French resistance 80 years ago. Finally, on September 2nd, word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So my dad walked into town, and the town square went up to an army major. It was an element of Patton's 3rd Army, which had come up through France after D-Day. He identified himself there and interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. And then he got a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris and then hopped on a transport to get back to England, where he sent a letter to my telegram saying, back at base, fit as a fiddle, bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay from being missing in action for 7 months. I love Belgium. When I give this presentation, most people don't realize it's divided in two, between Flanders and, I say Wallonia, which I know that's not the right pronunciation. And, how they speak Flemish in the northern part and speak French in the southern part. I don't have a pointer here, but you can see Charleroi there. My dad was hidden there. If you go straight down to the French-Belgian border, that's where really all the action took place. Actually, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, and the other members of the crew that were able to bail out came down in France, and they were brought across the border either by Germans who captured him or by the French resistance that brought him back into Belgium. The Belgian people to this day are still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans and the Allies coming to rescue them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a wonderful job of educating the younger generations as well. Dr. Delahaye, that I mentioned earlier, formed the Belgium American Foundation in 1984 to remember and honor events that took place, and they erected a number of memorials in the area. And on the anniversary date of those events, they have ceremonies, but the big ceremonies are all centered around September 2nd, when that area of the country or the nation was liberated. And they're wonderful events. They last several days. This is a poster from the 70th anniversary. And they erect these huge tents. This is just a portion of one. It seats hundreds of people. And they have band concerts and dances and lunches and dinners. And there's so much fun. The local volunteers dress in period outfits. And the Chimay beer just flows. And everyone has a very good time. But they also have solemn ceremonies at a number of memorials around this time, too. This is the memorial at Sundron, which was right at the French-Belgian border where the U.S. 9th Infantry first crossed over the Wartoise River from France into Belgium to liberate the country, or that area. And all the local villagers come out, all the local dignitaries make speeches. This is all around Montmagny and Chimay. The U.S. military is there, the Belgian military, the French military, the U.S. ambassador to Belgium comes down with an entourage. Again, you can see all the young people here in front, again, emphasizing the importance of remembering. And they're very solemn and moving events. This is the memorial to my dad's crew, which is in Mackinaws in Montmagny. Like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war until he went over for the dedication of this monument with three other crew members that were still living at the time. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground and revisited these places where it was hidden. And that brought it all back, and he started talking about it after that. Here you see my dad at the dedication. Again, the man with the beard is Dr. Paul Delahaye. And then next to my dad is Jeanette Gedin. I showed you her picture in an earlier picture, photo in an earlier picture. The elderly woman is Nellie Telkamp. That was the wife of the Belgium customs officer that helped my dad. A couple months later, after helping my dad, he was arrested, sent to prison, tortured, and just narrowly escaped being executed. But because of the beatings he took, he died about 5 years later. And then the man in the trench coat is the other person that helped my dad down from the trees, Raymond Durvan. I've been to Belgium 6 times, going for the 7th. In a few months, I can't wait for that. My first time was in 1994 with my parents. Here you see me, my dad, and then my mother, and the other woman there is my sister, Nancy. She was born while my dad was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mom. She's back home with a one-year-old baby, you know, Susan, and then an infant, Nancy, never knowing if she would see her husband again. On two of the occasions of going back to Belgium, I continued on to Munich, Germany to visit that Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane, Hans Berger, and we became friends. He was pretty much just like the U.S. airman. You know, he was 19, 20 years old, fighting for his country, you know, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. You know, he said it was unfortunate that we had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. And he would go, "We are not all evil Nazis." Here we are at his apartment. He's wearing his fighter jacket. You can't see his Iron Cross there. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire. But he was shot down 3 times himself. The only reason I think he made it through the war is that at the beginning of 1945, they pulled him out of combat to make him a test pilot for the Hinkel HE-162 single-engine jet fighter that the Germans were trying to perfect, which they never did. But I think that saved his life. I was hoping to see Hans this fall, but unfortunately he passed away this last January at age 100. And there we are at the Hofbräuhaus, having a cold one. Here's me and my dad at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. I accompanied him on a reunion trip for the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society. He wanted to see it before he died. It was right before the official opening. And it's the last trip he ever took. He died 3 years later at age 91. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91. And today, the veterans are all pushing 100 or over 100. At one time, there were 16 million World War II veterans. And as you can see from this graph, that number's been dwindling rapidly, and now there's less than 1% of them still with us. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom were without doubt the greatest generation. And their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. Thank you. I don't know if anyone has any questions. I'll be glad to field any if you have some. After my dad got back to England, they sent him back to the States to become a B-17 flight instructor for a while down at Hendricks Field in Sebring, Florida, and then at Lockburn Air Force Base in Ohio. The Air Force had a rule that if you were shot down and aided by the underground, that you couldn't go back in combat, because they thought if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give the identity of the people that helped you the first time. The only exception to that rule was Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him back into letting him in, back into combat. Yes, sir?
The entire
crew survived. Five made it, five did not. That's all I'll say.
What year did
Did you say the crash? Or?
The crew, how many of the crew survived that crash?
Well, how should I put that? Two died on the plane, eight bailed out. No one was in the plane when it crashed.
What year did Pekin Mustang play? Before that, we didn't have long range fighters that had bombers on the journey.
Right. Well, they started trickling in late December, but they really didn't come in until, early in 1944.
What year did your dad die?
2007. My mother died 5 months later. Just no point in living. They had been married for 65 years, and she was all alone. It was a very sad situation for those 5 months.
Were the other crew members aided by Belgian?
Yes. Yes, they were. And the book goes into detail on that. So there were happy endings and there were tragic endings to the crew. Well, it's a propeller, but it's just a fake propeller. Yeah, after the plane came down, the Germans circled the plane because they needed to use it as scrap metal because they were hurting so much for metal. Some Belgian people, they did salvage some parachutes that they made handkerchiefs, baby clothes, even a wedding dress out of. Little crosses were made out of the plexiglass. They were sent back to my mother and my grandmother, now my wife and my sister Nancy. I have them, so they're pretty special keepsakes. One of the times I was back at the anniversary celebrations, Belgian friend of mine said he knew this guy who was a military collector, he has all this stuff, he has pieces of the plane. So I'm just like beside myself, excited. And he brought us some pieces to the tent, and then he took us back to his house where he had this whole big museum, and he gave me pieces of it. And at the time, I actually thought it was pieces of my dad's plane. But then I found out later, with research, that actually it was a part of a British Halifax. So I was pretty disappointed about that.
Did you have any contact with the Tuskegee pilots?
No, my dad was in the 8th Air Force. The Tuskegee Airmen flew with the 15th Air Force out of Italy. So if you've seen Masters of the Air, that's an air one of the airs, showing that the Tuskegee Airmen, flew with the 8th Air Force. They did not fly with the 8th Air Force.
When and how did your mother find out he was alive?
Well, they were shot down on February 8th. She received a telegram from the War Department on February 23rd saying that the crew was missing in action. And a very personal and moving part of the book, too, was after the shot down. There's lots of excerpts from letters that mothers, wives, sweethearts exchanged during that time when they didn't know what happened. It was all just up in the air. And how hard they prayed and, just worried so much about their loved ones. Now I lost my train of thought. No. And then she did get another letter saying, well, he's still missing in action. But then not until September when my dad sent her that Western Union telegram, so it was like a little over 7 months, not knowing. So that was a glorious day.
I saw on the website that this incident might be featured in a movie or a movie around it.
Well, I forgot. I have a little 13-minute documentary if you'd like to see that. Actually, that has parts of an interview I did with Hans Berger, which is pretty interesting. But I'm in the process of pitching it to all the big producers in Hollywood. We'll see where that goes.
That ended his 7 months of missing in action. committed by the Nazis. To this day, they are so grateful and so thankful still for the Americans coming to the rescue of liberating them from Nazi oppression.
My father, Paul Delay, started the Belgian American Foundation in 1984. It was for the 40th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. The GIs that had been killed deserved the right to be honored and to receive homage from us because they gave their life for us.
Every year they have ceremonies at these various memorials that they've erected in the area on the anniversary date of those events. But the big celebrations are always on September 2nd, the anniversary of the liberation of Belgium.
Your father came the first time in 1988. I remember when he came the first time because we were very young, so that was the Americans. We had never seen Americans, so that was a bit crazy.
In 1994, I took my first trip to Belgium with my parents. There was an event. There were hundreds of people in this hall, and we were a little late arriving. My dad walked in, and the entire place stood up and started to applaud, and it was really moving. You know, they treated him like he was the president of the United States, which I'll never forget. And I had a whole lot of new appreciation for my dad, because you know, I knew these stories, but you know, when you hear the story, you know, it's not that personal to you. But when you're there, you know, see these places where the events took place. Been in the rooms where my dad was hidden. And he was right here. He climbed out this window and get up on this roof. And the history is preserved right there.
The locals really saved my dad's life. It's important for us to get him. He came here to liberate my country. Why wouldn't I help him?
I corresponded with him from the time I got back in the States. The wonderful, the brave people. I mean, they risked their lives for the encampment.
My parents have kept a lot of material from the war. There are two items that were written. One was a diary that my dad wrote by Lucy in action, and the other item wrote the letters that my dad wrote to my mother during the war that she had kept. Sitting down one time, many several hours reading this letter, I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his career, and it became my passion. I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his career was so unique and so compelling that he told people needed to hear about it, and so I decided to write one. Chopped Down focuses on one crew and what happened to each member of that crew. That just makes for a fascinating story. One that hasn't been told. All that the U.S. military knew was that my dad's plane was shot down by two thoughtful fraternal fighters. And I just assumed that's all I'd ever know. One day, during my research, my wife Glenn said, why don't you try to find a German pilot and shot him down? Well, like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. He's 95 years old now. He lives in Munich, Germany.
Here's a picture of Hans. That's the news that you're playing. You picture and your idol.
The young people of today have no idea what our life was, what the time was, what difficulties we had, and that we will not hold even Nazis, but we will people like you and me, and we just grew up in different spheres. I guess they are happy. My father and me met.
I've been asked several times, like, don't you hate this guy, Chuck, and your dad's plenty, but that no. From the very get-go, I felt a personal relationship with Hans, who was 20 years old, who was fighting for his country, who was trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. And World War II was the defining moment of my father's life, really, I think, the defining moment for any guy's life who fought in World War II. And Hans is a part of my dad's life, a part of his story. And so I had no ill feelings toward Hans, and we become friends.
Never thought that I'd meet the son of the guy I shot down.
You know, I never thought I'd meet you either. I know the facts, but I don't know the why or how he felt, because I never asked him about it until it was too late.
Yeah, I forgot to mention when I was talking that after I met Hans, you know, he's the one who told me that the gunners on my dad's plane shot him down at the same time that he shot my dad's plane down. They shot each other down. So thank you very much for coming out. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.